Good morning, everyone. I do want to encourage you 2 weeks from today, mark it down. Lunch is covered. We've got the fun fair, and it is the Papa Shot. That's what we're talking about. It is the little basketball game. There's two baskets. You know, you can, like, compete against somebody. So check it out. And then, truly, my favorite thing to do, I could do this for hours, we have a ring toss game, and there's, like, a little Coke, like a glass Coke bottle, and if you throw it and you get the thing that you know in the ring, and you just keep going back in line. So you'll see me out there. I'll just keep going back in line until I win one. I will keep throwing those plastic rings, and then it is just a true joy when you finally, you know, get one of those. So keep that in mind. Well, this morning we are continuing our series looking at biblical characters, and today we're looking at Paul. This week, I was reading the memoir of a guy named Bono. This is his book that came out in November. Some of you know about this book. I highly recommend it. It's fascinating. Some of you may not know who Bono is. Bono, some of you call him Bono, unfortunately. It is pronounced Bono. He is the lead singer of the band U2. And if you're around my age, or, you know, plus or minus 5 years, you will believe, like I do, that U2 is the best band in the history of the world. Those of you a little bit older will have lots to say about that. You disagree with that. Those of you, if you're in grade school, you'll know Bono as the guy who plays the lion in Sing 2. So that's he's like got some new fans, and it's a great movie as well. If you are a teenager or in your sort of early 20s, U2 is the band that your parents keep talking about. And if you are in your late 20s or early 30s, you're still a little bit bitter that about 10 years ago, this band had an album that showed up on your iPhone and you couldn't get rid of it, and you're still angry about it. Okay, that actually happened. Well, I do want to apologize to those of you in that category on behalf of the band U2 that they did that to you and ruined your life in that way. There's actually some good songs on the album. You should check it out. But anyway, Bono, I could go on and on about him. Very interesting guy, fascinating guy. But this week, it's a 40-chapter book, it's 40 short stories, and I've been kind of slowly working my way through because I kind of don't want it to be over. And I was in chapter 36. This, and just Wednesday morning, I was reading this section. Bono says, "I returned to a spiritual master like the Apostle Paul way back in the first century. I go to someone who overcame himself. I have so much to learn from this ancient writer. How does someone who first shows up as a monumental pain in the rear fundamentalist become someone who can write the greatest ode to love in 2,000 years? Somewhere on his spiritual path, he discovers love is bigger than anything in its way. That no matter what I say, what I believe, and what I do, I'm bankrupt without love." And then he quotes Eugene Peterson's translation of 1 Corinthians 13. So I just... Bono's such a great guy. What a great guy. He knew that I needed an intro to my sermon, and he knew that I would be, you know, getting to this right. He's such a great rock star. I love that guy. But it's not that surprising that Bono would talk about the Apostle Paul. He is a professed Christian. But I love how Bono says it. And that is the simplest way of talking about Paul, someone who was a fundamentalist. He was into cancel culture before it was cool. But he wasn't just canceling people, he was killing them. And yet, he became one of the most influential people in the history of the world, really. Consider this. An obscure Jewish leader from 2,000 years ago that we're going to be talking about today wrote a number of letters, among other things. And yesterday, one of the most powerful people in the world, the Prime Minister of the UK, read one of Paul's letters at the coronation of King Charles. He read a passage out of a letter to the church in Colossae. It doesn't make any sense how that might have happened, but Paul is who we're going to look at today. Many of you know a lot about him. Some of you don't. I didn't know much about Paul until I went to seminary, so if you don't know much, you're in the right place today. Perhaps the most important thing about Paul is that of the 27 books of the New Testament in the Bible, Paul wrote almost half of them. He wrote 13. And then a 14th book, the book of Acts, two-thirds of it is all about him. You could easily say that besides Jesus, He is the largest influence on shaping Christianity into what it's become. Now, we don't have time to read 13 letters and two-thirds of the book of Acts, but we're going to be asking the question, what can we learn from Paul? We're going to look at his life. I see it dividing up into four sections, and then I'm going to have five implications from his life that we're going to look at. So this man, Paul, also called Saul when we meet him, he's from the town of Tarsus, which is at the northeast tip of the Mediterranean Sea. He grew up a zealous follower of Judaism. And this first section of his life, I'm going to call ambition. We see ambition from this guy. He was trained up under the renowned leader Gamaliel, which was sort of like going to Harvard and graduating with honors. As Paul described it, he was a Pharisee among Pharisees. If you're not familiar with the term, the Pharisee is a Jewish religious leader of the day, and one who has a strong belief in the separateness of the Jewish people. Very legalistic, a strong emphasis on the law, the law, the law. And not just the law, but really doing everything you can to separate yourself. The holiness, following the law is everything to the Pharisees. And although he was trained up by Gamaliel, he rejected his mentor's wait-and-see approach to Jesus. We see in the book of Acts, chapter 5, this guy Gamaliel, he argues before his fellow Pharisees that these Christ followers that are starting to make some noise shouldn't be actively opposed. He says this, "If their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourselves fighting against God." You can almost imagine Paul sort of, you know, shaking his head at his mentor, that this is a dangerously open view towards this new attack on the one true religion, the one true God. Ironically, Paul would discover exactly what Gamaliel warned against. He found himself fighting against God, much to his surprise. We'll see that in a minute. Now, we have no reason to believe that Paul ever encountered Jesus before his meeting with him, which we're going to talk about in a sec. But you can be sure that the word spread quickly to Paul about how very little regard this young rabbi had for Pharisees. Jesus, of course, is killed, and that word gets around. But now he's beginning to hear that his followers are claiming that he has been raised from the dead after he was crucified. And the thought of a crucified Messiah, as people are being, you know, sort of sharing, had to have just been absolutely preposterous to Paul. There is no such thing as a Messiah who has been crucified. Paul describes himself as advancing in Judaism beyond many Jews of his own age, extremely zealous for the traditions of his fathers. So he sees what he has to do. As any good Pharisee would do, he would say, he has to preserve the integrity of the Jewish faith, preserve the honor of the very name of Yahweh. These rebels had to be stopped, and killing them was not out of the question because blasphemy is a capital offense in their laws. And so he sees anyone who would be following someone who is claiming to be God, claiming to forgive sins, it would be a righteous thing to do to put these folks to death. And so that's what he begins doing. And the first time we meet him, he's called Saul at the time. He's at the execution of Stephen, the first martyr recorded in the early church, chapter 7. It says he was giving approval to his death, and then he begins to destroy the church. Now remember, this is all done in the name of Yahweh. Saul was convinced he was serving God by his actions, doing God's work, ridding the earth of those who would come against the will of the creator of the universe. So we see that this ambition, it's misguided, of course, but it is relentless. So that's the first section is ambition. Second, I will call revelation and transformation. That's the second. Revelation and transformation. So we're going to be looking at Acts chapter 9. If you've got a Pew Bible, you can open that up. If you would like to, page 1087, you can open your devices if you would like, reading from Acts chapter 9. Verses 1 through 9. Meanwhile, Saul, again, he's known now as Saul, was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" "Who are you, Lord?" Saul asked. "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting," he replied. "Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but did not see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days, he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. So you picture this scene. Saul is on his way. He's trying to destroy the church in the name of Yahweh. Imagine maybe he's feeling a little underappreciated. He's like, you know, nobody really appreciates all the good I'm doing, but you know what? All that really matters is that God sees. You know, it's an audience of one. And then, boom, bright light on the ground. And then he hears a voice, "Saul, Saul." And he goes, okay. Maybe he's thinking, God does see. He's here to thank me. He's here because he appreciates so much all the good that I'm doing. And then, why are you persecuting me? Plot twist. Persecuting you. No, I'm not persecuting you. I'm persecuting the, oh no. And then he says, "Who are you, Lord?" And he has to imagine, he's thinking, please don't say Jesus. Please don't say Jesus. Anything but Jesus. "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." Dang it, that is not what he wanted to hear in that moment. So through this one encounter, he is transformed. His life would never be the same again. I want you to capture the weight of this moment. This is Saul becoming a Christian. This is like a Cubs fan becoming a Cardinals fan. Unthinkable, right? This is a Packers fan becoming a Bears fan. This is famous atheist Christopher Hitchens becoming a born-again Christian. Or maybe the closest parallel I could come up with would be the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan becoming the biggest civil rights proponent of his time. This is not a small transition. So what would make any of these scenarios happen? Well, it has to be some sort of massive revelation, which would lead to an unrivaled inner transformation. The commentator F.F. Bruce says this. He says, "No single event, save for the Christ event itself, has proved so determinant for the course of Christian history as the conversion and commissioning of Paul." And historically speaking, this is substantial evidence for the validity of Christianity itself. Only something as powerful as an experience with Jesus himself would have caused someone like Paul to do a complete 180 and become the biggest proponent of the very person he believed was a fraud. One 18th century writer says, "The conversion and apostleship of St. Paul alone, duly considered, was of itself a demonstration sufficient to prove Christianity to be a divine revelation." In fact, I really believe you could make the argument that just from Paul's letters alone, and I'll even go further. Let's pretend we don't have the Gospels. Let's pretend we don't have the Book of Acts. And let's even pretend that we don't have the 6 letters that Paul wrote that some liberal scholars and skeptics don't believe he wrote. I think he wrote all 13. There are some skeptics and liberal scholars who would say, well, we don't believe that he wrote all of them. But everybody believes that he wrote 7 of the 13 letters. The biggest skeptic, the biggest atheist, the biggest, you know, everybody believes that Paul wrote Galatians, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Romans, Philippians, 1st Thessalonians, and Philemon. Just in those writings alone, you'd have evidence that Paul hated Christians, he was actively persecuting them, he encountered the risen Jesus, and absolutely changed everything he believed and devoted his life to the very Jesus that he once hated. What do you do with that? I hope there are perhaps some skeptics here, perhaps online, who, you know, have maybe never considered. If you don't trust the Gospels, if you will just trust these seven letters that basically everybody agrees Paul wrote, that's the narrative. What do you do with that? You have to do something with the story of Paul. So for Paul, a mid-course correction was in order. This is a man who had it all figured out, and in the course of one brief encounter, everything he thought to be true had to be thrown out the window. I want to pause here and address a question that maybe some would be having as you hear the story, which is, why doesn't this happen more? Like, if this is a thing that changed the course of history, and you know, you've got this guy who hates Christians, and now he becomes, why don't we see this a whole lot more? And the easy answer to that question is we don't know. I mean, we just don't know. We don't control that, right? We don't control how God does, what God is going to do. That's not up to us. But I will say that if we had time to go around, even just in this room today, there are probably people here who would say, yeah, I wasn't knocked off my horse. I didn't experience anything as dramatic as that. But I had that thing that happened that I can't explain. And that's changed me. I look at this part of my life, this moment or whatever it might be, where I just say, yeah, that was a supernatural experience. And lots of people can point to those things and say, I know that God is real because of that thing that happened to me. Many of you heard about the Asbury revival that happened at this Christian college, Asbury, a couple months ago. And the stories, I was so encouraged when I heard about that. It was just people that started a chapel service, not even the whole chapel, just a few people stuck around after a chapel service one day, and they couldn't explain it except that they just felt the presence of God in the room that they didn't expect. It was unexpected. And then others came, and that's sort of the report that came out. If you listen to some of the testimonies, is that they just said, yeah, I don't quite understand it, but there was just this presence of God in a way that transformed me. When God moves, and we don't get to choose that, but when God moves, people's lives are changed. So that is part two, revelation and transformation. The third section is less discussed, but it's very important, and that is reflection. So even after this incredible encounter, Paul takes time to reform his theology. He says in the letter to the Galatians, he says he doesn't consult with the other apostles so that people couldn't accuse him of just getting the story from them. He spends 3 years in Arabia and Damascus, which is a long time to spend on the sideline. When you've had this encounter and you just want to tell everybody about what you've experienced, that's a long time to sit back and reflect. I can understand this just a little bit. When I knew that I wanted to go into ministry, I had some friends that I looked up to that never went to seminary, and they just kind of went into ministry, and I was kind of excited about that. Yeah, let's go get it done. I had a mentor in my life who said, I really think you should go to seminary. I think you'd really benefit from it. And I had heard different, you know, voices of opinion. Some said, yeah, seminary, it's like cemetery. They'll kill you. All of your passion will go out. You don't need that. You just need to go out. And, of course, I wanted that shortcut. I'm like, yeah, let's just go. And I had another wise friend, not the one who had told me that I should go, just another guy who said, so I know you're considering seminary. Well, how long do you think you might do ministry? Like, if you go into it, I said, I don't know. I would hope 30, 40 years maybe. And he said, and seminary is 3 years. So do you think that maybe taking 3 years to invest in that 40 might be a good use of your time? And I said, yeah, that's actually probably really smart. And I would say to all of you in here, you should be very lucky that I went to seminary, because woe to anyone who without seminary would have been terrible. I didn't know what I didn't know, and I learned that in seminary. I'm so grateful that I had this time of reflection and investing in what I didn't know so that I could then move into a time of ministry. And that's what this last stage of his life is, that I will just call passion. Paul lived with passion. He has ambition before, but now he has this spirit-driven passion to go with it. He travels from place to place. He reasons with people. He waits for the Lord to guide and to direct. And as someone shared with me in the last service, everywhere Paul went, there was either a revival or a riot, right? So he is great things happening, and then he's in trouble, and they're having to get him out so that he's not killed. I mean, he is absolutely a man possessed. And that will constitute the pattern for the rest of his life. What Paul demonstrated in his writings, as well as his personality, is that he has what I would call a both-and kind of personality that I really admire in him. He was passionate, but he was also quite thoughtful. He was a poet, but he was also a scholar. In other words, he had a heart and he had a head. He was often solemn. He said he would gladly give up his own salvation if it meant that more of his Jewish brothers and sisters would become followers of Jesus, but he also could be a little salty. He had a sense of humor. In Galatians, he's talking about the people who think that a Gentile has to become circumcised in order to be a true Christian. And he uses sarcasm to great length to say that if they wish circumcision on the Gentiles, he wishes castration on them. A little bit salty, right, for the scriptures. He was conceptual. He goes to great lengths to describe what Christ's death means, but he's also practical. He says to Timothy, you should have a little bit of wine to help with your upset stomach. He was persuasive in his outreach, right? He's going to the temples. He's reasoning with people. But he's also dependent on the move of God. He says in 1 Corinthians 2, he comes with a demonstration of God's power so that the faith of the people that he's sharing with doesn't just rest on his words, but on the power of God. He was passionate about seeing the gospel spread. He wants to meet the spiritual needs of the people he's talking to, but he's also passionate about the physical needs. It says in Galatians 2 that they should remember the poor. He was gracious, especially when it involved newcomers to the faith, but he wasn't afraid to be a little bit confrontational, especially when it was with people who he thought should know better. And yet, even in one instance where he disagrees with someone, the book of Acts talks about he and Barnabas split up because Paul didn't think they could trust Mark. We see that Mark is later listed in one of his letters, so we see that he's reconciled to Mark. He knows that he's not the treasure. Right? He knows that we're jars of clay. We're simple jars that carry this incredible gift, this treasure. So he's passionate, but he also knows not to take himself too seriously. We can also learn from this both-and approach about his attitude towards death. He says, to live is Christ, and to die is gain, which is another way of saying, either way, I can't lose. The joy that I'm experiencing right now in this life is real. I know Christ. I'm living to experiencing him in my everyday encounter with Christ, and yet dying is gain because then I get to go and be with him forever. Paul's passion is also then to know Christ himself, but also to make Christ known. I'm going to look quickly at a couple of passages. You can turn to Philippians 3, starting in verse 7 if you want. He's explaining all of the things that he's done, all of the ways that he has earned favor with God, but then realizes that once he knows Christ, all of that can be thrown out. Philippians 3 and verse 7, whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish, that I may gain Christ and be found in him. Skipping down to verse 10. I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow to attain to the resurrection from the dead. Knowing Christ is at the heart of Paul. But he also wanted to do everything in his power to help others know Christ. In another famous passage in 1 Corinthians 9, he says, to the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law to win those under the law. And then he says, I've become all things to all people so that by all possible means, I might save some. He says, I'm not going to change the message, but I want to do whatever I can when I'm over here with this group to help them understand. And when I go over here, I want to help them. I'm going to frame it in this way so that everybody that I meet might be able to know Christ. So we would have this. We would do well to have this balance too. If all we do is say, well, I'm just going to know Christ, that's all I care about, well, we're missing out on this call of that we have to go live our faith out, that others might know. If all we care about is letting others know about Christ, then we're gonna burn out. So as we wrap up our time, and as we head into the Lord's Supper, I've got five implications, things that I think we can learn from Paul's life that would inform ours. The first one is this: God reaches the unlikeliest of people. Don't you know that people who knew Saul, knew about Saul, would have thought, yeah, that guy is certainly not going to become a Christian. There is no chance that's happening. And I think many of us, if we're followers of Jesus and we have a desire for others around us to know him, we probably have a list of people who we say, well, that person's never going to happen. And I think we shouldn't give up. We shouldn't give up praying. We shouldn't give up loving. We shouldn't give up gently persuading others to know Christ themselves. Number two, some need a mid-course correction. You might be like Paul. You're headed down one path, and maybe even today you're saying, yeah, I've been living for myself. I've believed. Maybe even you're a fundamentalist. You say, yeah, I know the truth. I know I've got this figured out. And you need to know Christ and have this mid-course correction, that Jesus is worthy of your life. Number three is that you can't earn God's love. What great news, right? I don't think it was probably great news to Paul because he thought, look at all the good I'm doing. I deserve something from God because of all that I've earned. Well, we can't, and so we don't have to try. That's the great message of the gospel, which is that Jesus earns us the righteousness that we can never earn for ourselves. And he lives that out. Paul calls himself the chief of sinners. And he knows that God can redeem him. There's nothing we can do to earn God's love. Fourth, a life of following Jesus involves suffering. I want you to pay attention to this. Paul was God's chosen vessel to carry his name before the Gentiles, and he was called to a life of suffering. You might argue that Paul was one of God's favorites, right? I mean, boy, he had a big mission, and yet he allows Paul to partake in the life that Jesus lived as well, which is suffering. So later in the chapter that we read before from Acts, chapter 9, God calls another man, Ananias, to go give Paul a message. In verse 15, the Lord said to Ananias, go, this man is my chosen instrument to proclaim my name to the Gentiles and their kings and to the people of Israel. Now, if I was Ananias, I would think, oh, okay, so I'm going to have great news to share with this chosen vessel. Okay, what do you want me to tell this chosen vessel, Lord? Verse 16, I will show him how much he must suffer for my name. Oh, I did not see that coming. I did not see that coming at all. If we are called, we should expect from time to time to suffer. If Jesus suffered, if Paul suffered for the sake of Christ, we should expect to suffer. Now, everyone will suffer in life, whether you're a Christian or not, but there are certain things that happen in our lives as we are following Jesus that God will allow us to experience for our good. And I don't know about you, I don't like to suffer. I every chance I get, I want to do everything I can. No, get that out of the way. I'm going to pray that away. No one likes to suffer. But if we understand that when suffering comes because of the name of Christ, that might mean that something is right. And as difficult as it is to suffer, when we follow Jesus, there are times when we will be expected to suffer. I heard someone say, you've heard, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And we do tend to run away from things like that. And someone said, sometimes in the Christian life, you just need to get a fan and stay in the kitchen, because that's, you're doing what you're supposed to do there. Get a fan. You're in the right place. That's number four. Number five is that an encounter with God changes everything. Paul had so much going for him. He had the correct beliefs. He had the respect of his peers. I can imagine that, his fellow Pharisees might have said, there goes Saul. If only we had what he has. And yet, it was not the right stuff. It's not what he needed. What he needed was an encounter with God, and that changed everything. And what that is, we're not going to have an experience. Most of us aren't going to have an experience like Paul had. But what we do have is the Holy Spirit. Jesus has sent the Holy Spirit. And that is what can change us every single day. And what is the Holy Spirit but the experience of God's love? A regular encounter to know the love of God. And at the end of the day, it really was about this incredible love displayed on the cross, revealed to Paul in this violent but ultimately merciful revelation. And what Paul discovered, and the example for us, is that at the center of everything, and I mean at the center of the universe, is a being that is full of a powerful and a transformational love. A love, as Bono says, it's bigger than anything in its way. That is the incredible message of the gospel. And that when we experience that love, it changes absolutely everything. And as we come to the communion table, that is the kind of love that we celebrate. Would you pray with me? Father, thank you for the example of the Apostle Paul, that you redeemed his life and you let him be an example for us to follow. But more, we thank you for Jesus. We thank you for the cross. We thank you for that love displayed once for all, that we know you are love because of the cross. And we come to celebrate that now. In your name, amen.